Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, after the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. in 1968, cities around the country saw protests, riots, and looting. We'll look back at how President Lyndon Johnson's handling of the situation compares to President Trump's today. First, Republican state lawmakers are voicing their frustration with Governor Evers after a secret recording of a recent meeting surfaced. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel obtained the recording through an open records request. The conversation is between Evers, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, and Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald, and runs about an hour. It took place the day after the Wisconsin Supreme Court struck down the state's stay-at-home order.
In a perfect world, we would open up bars just like they did in any other state, with some sort of parameter, instead of seeing pictures today of bars absolutely bursting at the seams, knowing full well that there's all sorts of viruses being transmitted. Would we have preferred not to happen? Yes. But, we understand we're going to move.
Governor, when was the last time you were in Home Depot on a Saturday? When was the last time you were in Walmart on a Saturday? Are you kidding me? You're not being serious right now, are you? Those places are bursting at the seams every weekend.
An Evers spokesperson said the recording was made for internal use only to supplement note-taking and future COVID-19 planning. Fitzgerald called the move Nixon-esque, and Voss called it shameful. Earlier today, Governor Tony Evers talked about the recording and some other issues with Central Time host Rob Ferret.
Well, I want to talk about the state's COVID-19 current situation, but I want to start with some breaking news that kind of came out of that. This conversation about a month ago you had with legislative leaders, and now news is out about it being secretly recorded. One of your spokespeople says you didn't know about that. Is that true?
Yeah, that's true. From what I understand, it was recorded so that it helped them in note-takings because it was relatively important meeting, and no, I didn't know it was taped, and once I did find out, I said that's not our protocol, and we aren't going to do that going forward.
And is anybody going to be disciplined for the decision in making that recording?
Well, certainly I'm talking to the people that were involved with it, and it's a personnel matter, so I'm not going to go into it, but we're having discussions about that.
And Majority Leader Fitzgerald has said in 26 years in the legislature, this is one of the most brazen examples of unethical, unprofessional conduct I've ever seen. Your working relationship with these Republican leaders, not great to begin with. Have you reached out to try to make amends here?
Well, we'll have a discussion. I mean, certainly we have a state to run, so clearly we need to get together to do that. And we've had thousands and thousands of people all across the state, from Milwaukee to Rhinelander, that have been protesting around issues that frankly transcend this issue. And so we're going to continue making sure that the people of Wisconsin who have spoken out around the issue of social justice and racial inequality, that their voices are heard, and we're going to have the leadership on board around that issue.
Well, let's move on to COVID-19 more specifically now. Overall, how do you feel about where Wisconsin is in trying to limit the spread of this disease?
Well, we've done a good job. First of all, the people of Wisconsin have done a good job. The Safer at Home saved thousands of lives, or hundreds of lives, and thousands of people getting COVID-19, and that's carrying forward. So if you look at the percent of people that are testing positive now, it's anywhere from 5% to 2%, and that's we'd like to have it be zero, clearly, but until we have a vaccine, we won't. So I think that's a good number. I am concerned about the issue of the availability of ICU units for our hospitals. Of course, they've gone back to doing the work that they should do around the rest of things besides COVID-19. And as a result, the usage of certain things that might be needed for a surge, that's a little concerning, but it We are doing a good job around the contact tracing and the testing and all the things that need to be in place as we move forward.
We see in some states, Texas most notably, a jump, a peak in hospitalizations because of COVID-19. What is your message for people in Wisconsin as they go about their daily lives to try to prevent that happening here?
Yeah, and that's the most important thing, because it's really simple. Stay six feet apart as much as you can. Wear a mask and do the hygiene thing. Make sure that you're using washing your hands regularly. Making sure that all that simple stuff is in place. And I think we'll be fine. But anytime we cram a bunch of people in a small space, that's a recipe for the transmission of the disease. So it's pretty simple stuff, and I think we're in a better place, certainly a better place with our public health system than we were before.
Turning to the economic fallout of COVID-19, the Department of Workforce Development got hundreds of thousands of unemployment claims since mid-March. Still a lot. I've seen numbers in the neighborhood of 15% still being processed. Where is the state on catching up and staying on top of those claims?
Yeah, we continue to hire people on a regular basis. We've contracted with some call services. We're making progress. I mean, a lot of this, so frankly, is that it's not. You know, I understand that people are frustrated that are waiting to get a call in, but we also spend a lot of time and effort and time kind of working through claims that we need more information on, and we have some problems with fraud with people also, not surprisingly, because it's such a large system. But it's getting better. It's not perfect, but it's getting better. And obviously, at the end, we're going to have to take a look as a state to change our system. The computer system is 50 years old, I believe, something in that category, and we can't fix that while it's like flying an airplane and fixing it at the same time. We can't do that, but we're getting people involved and cleaning up the backlog.
Talking to Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers about the state's COVID-19 response and about protests around the state. And let's turn to that now, Governor Evers. Earlier this week, you deactivated the Guard after their role helping police deal with protests. Can you talk about the role they played?
Yeah, the Guard, you know, we only went where we were asked. And our bottom line in agreeing to putting the Guard in any place was that they had a limited role as far as police actions. Their role was around protecting infrastructure, whether it was electrical, whether it was water, whether it was other infrastructure items across the state. For example, in Madison, guarding making sure the state capitol and other state assets were protected. Simple as that. They did a great job. They were out there a long time, and we collectively decided that it was time to let those our friends and neighbors who are part of the National Guard to go home.
We're seeing at the federal level efforts in Congress to change laws when it comes to law enforcement. Here in the state, you've asked the legislature to take up some kind of overhaul. What kind of changes do you have in mind?
Well, we have to start someplace, and I believe the Assembly Bill 1012 dealing with use of force is a good start. It certainly is a thing that was part of what happened in Minnesota and Minneapolis with Mr. Floyd in that horrible situation. And so I believe that would be a good place for the legislature to start and hopefully pass that bill. Use of force is important, but we also have to take advantage of this. This is an important time, watershed time for our state, when we have people from southeast Wisconsin, rural Wisconsin, Rhineland, or other places across the state, standing up and saying enough is enough. We have to approach and deal with this issue of social injustice and racial inequities in a proactive way. We have a chance to change things in the state, and change things in the country. We just have to have the wherewithal and, frankly, the stick-to-itiveness to make that happen. I believe dealing with the use of force is a good place to start.
As we wrap up, Governor Evers, some people in the state look at these protests and applaud. They hope that the changes protesters want will happen. Other people look and are worried about, you know, when they see windows broken, stores looted, they're worried about things spinning out of control. What would you say to that second group to reassure them?
Well, first of all, the reassurance is this, is that that happened in a very small number of cases and small number of people. The vast majority of people that were out, whether it was Milwaukee, Madison, Rhinelander, Tolma, Plymouth, Sheboygan, they're there in order to say to the world and the government, do something. We have to take care of this. Yes, that you know, who can be happy about seeing vandalism and looting go on? But at the end of the day, the most important thing that we have to do is make sure that the voices are heard of the vast majority of people that said we need change.
Governor Evers, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob. Have a good day.
Tony Evers is the Democratic governor of Wisconsin. He talked with Rob Ferret earlier today about the secret recording his staff made of a meeting he had with Republican lawmakers after the Supreme Court struck down the stay-at-home order. We also touched on the state's handling of the coronavirus pandemic and response to the protests over George Floyd's death. Later this hour, we'll hear from the Assembly Majority Leader, Republican Jim Steinke, about his thoughts on the recording. Coming up, we'll look back at how President Lyndon Johnson responded to protests and riots in 1968 and what it can teach our leaders today about the situation we're in. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, going back to any semblance of what normal life used to be probably depends on the availability of a vaccine against the novel coronavirus. We'll find out what it would take for one to be available within 18 months. First, the protests and unrest around the country in the 2 weeks since George Floyd's death in police custody have been compared to the events of April 1968. In the wake of Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination, dozens of cities saw demonstrations and some destructive riots. The rhetoric coming from the White House, however, was noticeably different. While President Lyndon Johnson condemned violence, he also voiced an understanding of people's anger and signed a fair housing bill just over a week later. Our next guest says there's a lot today's leaders could learn from one of the nation's most tense moments. Kyle Longley is a professor of history and political science at Arizona State University. He's the author of several books, including LBJ's 1968, Power, Politics, and the Presidency in America's Year of Upheaval. Kyle, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
Well, as we said, there's been a lot of comparing of our current moment to those 1968 protests and riots. Can you start by comparing the two situations in terms of the challenge they created for a president?
Well, for the president, of course, it was finding in 1968 the fine line between denouncing the violence but also acknowledging what the root causes were. And President Johnson did a fairly good job of recognizing that despite all that had been done in 64 and 65, that so much more still remained to do. He also saw that the riots were a reflection on the problems that were in the inner cities, in the deltas, all the different parts of the country, of African Americans and their frustration, including that with how the police forces responded to them.
Tell us how, in the very immediate aftermath of Dr. King's assassination, in the next day or two, what were some of President Johnson's first public statements and actions as the riots were starting around the country?
Well, one of the first things he did was organize a meeting at the White House of civil rights leaders to discuss the issues and what to try to accomplish to assuage some of the challenges that existed. Then he took the whole group. They went to a memorial service at the National Cathedral, and then he returned home and returned to the White House, flanked by these same leaders, and called for calm and called for nonviolence, but also acknowledged that Congress and the country needed to do a lot more to help these people address the issues of socioeconomic disparities and the frustrations with the violence being perpetrated on them by, security forces.
How would you rate President Johnson's statements about racial justice, not just those in public speeches, but in private meetings? How strong were his feelings and his expressions on this topic?
Much stronger than what we've seen, come out of the White House today. He clearly understood the struggles. And while he had not been able to accomplish all he wanted to, he definitely wanted to accomplish more. And he had done probably more on civil rights and for the poor, of which many were African-American, than any American president since FDR. And on political, he did far past what FDR did. But he also understood there was still so much more to do. And in private, he would say things like, I understand why someone looks and they see their leaders assassinated and why they might want to pick up a gun, or why when you've had somebody the foot on their neck for so long, for 400 years, that when they get up, the first thing they want to do is knock your block off. So he did show empathy, which I think, again, is a contrast to what we're seeing today. The riots in 68 were much worse. They did order the troops into Washington, D.C., but the difference is President Johnson told his leaders and told the commanders, you better not injure anyone if at all possible. And he was getting pressured. Senator Byrd from West Virginia told him, well, we need to shoot them, but only the adults and only in the leg. So he was getting pressured to respond much more so. But in the whole time U.S. troops occupied Washington, D.C., only 3 bullets were fired.
We're talking right now with Kyle Longley. He's a professor of history and political science at Arizona State University. He's the author of several books, including LBJ's 1968, Power, Politics, and the Presidency in America's Year of Upheaval. And we are talking about how President Johnson reacted to the widespread protests and riots in 1968, taking a look at how we can compare that to today. As you just said, President Johnson didn't condone the violence or the looting, even though he could understand some of the source of that action. The Fair Housing Bill that he signed a week after Dr. King's death did include anti-rioting provisions. Let's take a listen to some of what he had to say after signing that legislation.
We all know that the roots of injustice run deep. But violence cannot redress a solitary wrong or remedy a single unfairness. And we just must put our shoulders together and put a stop to both. The time is here. Action must be now.
So listening to that, do you hear echoes of feelings and intent that President Johnson had leading up to these events and also in the weeks, months, and years that followed?
Yes. Well, first of all, I think it's important to contextualize. He'd already dealt with a series of riots, Watts in 65, Detroit in 67. This is just the culmination in 68 of many of these things. And again, the first two related to police violence against African-Americans. So I think he definitely saw that the violence was leading to a backlash, and that was one of the first things that he wanted to address. And he also, I think, to a degree, despite his differences with Martin Luther King, understood King's commitment to nonviolence and how that tied into the whole effort to do things like the Fair Housing Act.
What kind of response did President Johnson get from members of his own party and from others?
He wanted to push through another multi-billion-dollar plan to help the inner cities in particular, and he ran headlong into strong opposition. The pivotal election in the 1960s is not 1968, I don't think. I think it's 1966 when you see such a backlash against what would be characterized as liberal Democrats. And the conservative Democrats who leave the party in the 70s and 80s, they firmly had their heels dug in, and they weren't going to do anything further. And they felt like they had Johnson on the run. And it's also important to contextualize that on March 31st, he had announced he wasn't going to seek re-election. So in essence, he's a lame duck president.
President Johnson did ultimately deploy the military in different American cities. What brought him to that decision when it seems like that was probably something that he was hoping not to have to do?
Well, the amount of violence. I mean, we're talking, they can smell the embers of burning buildings in the White House on those spring days in April. And so the other part of it that I think a lot of people may miss is he also felt like by putting the military in, he had more control over trying to limit the violence because he did not trust the number of the police forces. He did not trust the number of the mayors and governors not to overreact. In fact, he put one of the first things he did was he put a number of his people on the ground in Memphis to try to prevent the Buford Ellington, the governor, from really cracking down hard and creating more violence. And that was one of his major goals, was try to limit the damage, try to limit the violence. And he felt more faith in the federal troops than he did on the National Guard and, of course, the local police.
And briefly, in our last minute, how would you compare the response in these days after the George Floyd killing in police custody? How would you compare President Trump's reaction to that of LBJ in 68?
Well, it's complete opposite. No empathy has been shown, no really understanding that there are deeper roots to the problems. And again, if anything, wanting to use more force, and including the federal government. But fortunately, generals and others pushed back on that within the Pentagon. So I would say it's 180 degrees difference. Did Johnson handle it perfectly? Absolutely not. But did he do a much better job than what, unfortunately, we're seeing right now? He sought to unify, not divide. And that's why he brought the civil rights leaders in. That's why he talked to the mayors and said, get out into the streets and try to calm this down before it gets out of hand. And also why he was trying to go to Congress to try to get programs passed to try to address the fundamental roots of the problems.
Well, Kyle, thank you so much for joining us today.
My great pleasure. Have a great day.
You too. Kyle Longley is a professor of history and political science at Arizona State University. He's the author of several books, including LBJ's 1968, Power, Politics, and the Presidency in America's Year of Upheaval. He talked with us about how President Johnson's response to protests and riots in 1968 compares to President Trump's rhetoric today. Coming up, we'll find out what it will take to get a coronavirus vaccine in the next 18 months. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk about what would need to happen for a vaccine against the novel coronavirus to be available to the public in the next 12 to 18 months. Now, a secret recording of a May phone meeting between Governor Tony Evers and Republican leaders was made public yesterday by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. The conversation revolved around how the state government could respond to the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. A staff member in the governor's office recorded the conversation between Evers and Assembly Speaker Robin Voss and Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald. According to the governor's office, the recording was made for note-taking purposes and that the governor was not aware that the recording was happening. The news of the recording has angered GOP lawmakers and could impact how the GOP and the governor work together in the future. Representative Jim Steinecke is the majority leader in the state assembly and represents the 5th Assembly District, which includes Kaukauna. Representative spoke with Central Time host Rob Ferret earlier this afternoon about the issue.
Well, what was your initial reaction to the news of this recording made without the knowledge or consent of two of your colleagues in the legislature?
Yeah, I mean, really, I was just shocked, kind of disappointed. I mean, this is yet another new low in our political discourse these days, and the lack of trust seems to be getting deeper and wider, the gap between us, and this is obviously doing no good in, bridging that gap.
I talked to Governor Evers earlier today. He said what he's been telling the press. He didn't know about it. He said his staff did this solely for purposes of note-taking later on. What are your thoughts on that explanation?
To me, if it was somebody in my office that did this without my knowledge or without the knowledge of the people on the other end of the call, they would be fired immediately. I mean, there has to be consequences for this. if nobody on the call knew it was being taped, then it's illegal. And that's something that we need to be very careful about. And if we're going to have constructive dialogue going forward and try to bridge this political gap and try to work on these major issues that are facing us, we have to be able to have a minimum level of trust with each other. And this really harms that.
Yeah, the governor told me they were reviewing this from a personnel standpoint. He couldn't say more beyond that. He said, what are you hoping comes out of this when it comes to possible repercussions?
Well, honestly, like I said, if it was somebody in my office, they would lose their position immediately. I mean, there's no question about it. If I wasn't aware of it and nobody on the call was aware of it, that person wouldn't be working for me any longer. So no, there's bipartisan calls for the person responsible to be fired. And if indeed Governor Evers is telling the truth and he wasn't aware of it, I would expect that somebody would have to pay the consequences for such a terrible action.
Have you, in your legislative career, heard of something like this, people just recording conversations, whether for the purposes of note-taking or whatever?
No, not without everybody's knowledge of people around the table. I mean, that's just not something that's done. Unless we want to get to a point where we're negotiating everything out in front of the cameras, which just leads to, political posturing and playing to your base. This is the kind of thing that can't happen. I mean, I haven't heard of something like this since the Nixon administration.
This is a latest step in what's not been a great relationship here between the governor and Republicans in the legislature. Do you see a road to get from where everybody is now to a better working relationship?
I certainly hope so. I mean, I've always been one that says we can't take politics personally. It's just not within our rights. We're representing the people back home, and we have to do it without allowing our personal feelings to get in the way. But that being said, something like this goes beyond personal feelings. It goes beyond, it goes to the level of trust and being able to know that you can have these conversations without them turning political. And, so that's going to be a challenge going forward, but I'll do everything I can to put this behind us. But it's important that somebody pays the price for it. Otherwise, I can't trust that it wasn't sanctioned by the governor.
Talking to Republican State Assembly Representative Jim Steinecke, majority leader in the State Assembly, looking at recordings made apparently by the governor's staff without the knowledge or consent of Republican leaders on a phone conversation. So what do you want next to hear from the governor, maybe to Representative Voss and Senator Fitzgerald, apart from repercussions to the staff here? What do you want to be hearing from the governor right now after this?
I think the governor should come out and, at a minimum, apologize to the legislative leaders and really, more importantly, to the public for allowing his staff to get so far out of control that they would do something without his knowledge. I think that would help heal the divide if there were some consequences and there was, an apology acknowledging that, that this was done in a way that should never be repeated.
I've seen some open government advocates say, hey, why not have these conversations in the public eye? Why not, these are important things for the state. Why not have the governor and Republican leaders sit down in some kind of public forum? Could we do that? Is that something that would be worth doing?
Yeah, I mean, I believe in transparency, and I think a vast majority of the legislating that goes on should be done in front of the public in hearings and in executive sessions and committees and things of that nature. But when you're trying to find common ground and we're trying to feel each other out and figure out where there's room for compromise, some of that needs to be more private so you don't have that political posturing and so people aren't constantly playing to their base. It makes it much easier if you can have those candid conversations.
We'll keep watching for what happens on this story and what comes from the governor on it. At the same time, we've got a lot, of course, going on in the state, COVID-19 and the economic consequences, protests, concerns about police reform. Do you see you and your colleagues in the legislature coming back into session to tackle some or all of these issues anytime soon?
Well, we've said all along, you know, as far as the economics and the fiscal situation that the state faces, that we may need to come back in before the end of the calendar year. We've asked the governor to consider freezing state spending in the second year of the budget, because if we increase spending going into the second year, it's just going to make the cuts deeper and tougher to bear come next year, when we all expect our revenues are going to be down from what was projected. So that's something that I think we'd like to come back in on at some point, and we probably likely will have to with the budget repair bill. And then as far as issues like police reform, I think we desperately need to have a bigger conversation with, you know, leaders in the communities of color throughout the state, along with law enforcement and faith leaders and legislators on how we move forward in a way that we ensure that we prevent situations like what happened with George Floyd in Minneapolis.
Representative Steinicke, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
That was Representative Jim Steinicke speaking with Central Time host Rob Ferret. Steinicke serves as the Republican majority leader in the state assembly and represents the 5th Assembly District, which includes Kaukauna. Steinicke joined us today to talk about a secret recording made by Governor Evers' office of a meeting with Republican leaders last month. Coming up, we'll find out what it would take to have a vaccine against the novel coronavirus in a year to 18 months. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, we'll revisit a conversation with best-selling author Ann Patchett about how social distancing and stay-at-home orders have changed reading for many of us, including her. She shares recommendations for reading right now and what she's been reaching for. Now, after months of lockdowns, social distancing, and a complete change in how we work, play, and live, a lot of attention and hope is turning to the development of a vaccine for the novel coronavirus. Immunologist Dr. Anthony Fauci of the White House Coronavirus Task Force had this to say earlier this month.
By the beginning of 2021, we hope to have a couple of 100 million doses.
But what would need to happen for that timeline to be possible? Marcos Garcia Ojeda is a professor of molecular and cell biology at the University of California, Merced. He wrote a piece for The Conversation titled, What Needs to Go Right to Get a Coronavirus Vaccine in 12 to 18 Months? Marcos, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Judith.
Well, there are a few different types of vaccines, and you think that those that are genetically based have the most promise for a coronavirus vaccine. First, can you start us off by briefly explaining how that type of vaccine works?
So, Judith, that type of vaccine works a little bit different than traditional vaccines, where a inactivated or killed microorganism is injected into a person. What we are now trying to do is to use DNA or RNA, which are the molecules that encode the information to make proteins, and inject those directly into a tissue of a patient, like the muscle. And there, the muscle cells will then read the information and make a protein that resembles the one in the virus. So we're no longer using a viral particle per se, but having the information delivered by the DNA or RNA molecule to now be able to make the protein. And in that way, now we trigger the immune response based on that foreign protein that has been given to the person in the form of that genetic information.
And why do you think that that type of vaccine, as you said, not the most usual kind of vaccine that we're used to, why do you think that that type specifically would be the best for the coronavirus?
Well, part of the issue is that the time that it takes to generate a traditional vaccine using the tested methodology could take up to 10 years for some of them. So this kind of new technology can shorten the amount of time that the vaccine could be produced from the point in which the vaccine is developed by the manufacturings to the point that it gets to the people. Generating DNA and RNA is a lot faster. It's very direct. It doesn't usually require to have the killing of the microorganism per se. And oftentimes DNA and RNA is a lot more stable. So you have issues that are going to most likely expedite the ability of manufacturers to be able to have a vaccine available for delivery. So that is one issue. The other one is the potential elimination of side effects that may have when you're injecting a very defined molecule like an RNA molecule. So taken together, those could be potential benefits that may lead us to a vaccine that is available in a shorter amount of time. That said, the challenge that we have is that we have never had a vaccine developed using RNA that has been available to people, and we have only have vaccines using DNA available for animals in veterinary use. So we are still not have a vaccine using either DNA or RNA that has been used for people.
So I want to make sure that I'm understanding this. So with the injection of the protein, what does that mean? Say this vaccine works and I get immunized with it, and then I'm exposed to the coronavirus. What happens in my body then?
Once you get a protein made in your body, your immune cells are going to recognize that protein as a foreign agent, and they're going to launch an immune response. Ideally, you will have an immune response that will have two components: B cells that are going to produce antibodies, and antibodies are the molecules, proteins that can directly recognize and eliminate the microorganism. But the second one, it's going to be a T cell response. And T cells are, I tend to think of them as the general and soldiers of the immune system. The helper cell is the one that coordinates the entire immune response, and the killer cell is the one that is going to actually destroy viral infected cells. So oftentimes, simply injecting a protein can lead to antibody response, but not often to T cell responses. So maybe one of the things that a vaccine that is ideal would be to tickle both arms of the immune system, both the antibody response and the T cell response. So the other thing that is that we would like to have that agent that you're using in the vaccine to give you long-lasting immunity. And that is something that is still somewhat unknown against the coronaviruses, for example.
We're talking right now with Marcos Garcia Ojeda. He's a professor of molecular and cell biology at the University of California, Merced. And he wrote a piece for The Conversation titled, What Needs to Go Right to Get a Coronavirus Vaccine in 12 to 18 Months. Now, Marcos, as you said earlier, it can take a long time, usually in the more traditional way of producing vaccines, to get a vaccine that's ready for market. The average is about 10 years. They are also very expensive to produce. Mm-hmm. And I think in your article, you said an average of $1 to $5 billion. So
yes.
How you talked a little bit about how we can speed up the timeline. Where is that investment money going to come from?
Well, right now there are some partnerships from private foundations, the government, and of course, companies that are working together to try to get the funding and as well push forward the developing a vaccine. Recently, there was an Operation Warp Speed, which is a public-private partnership initiated by the government that it has never done before. It's an unprecedented partnership to try to accelerate the development, the manufacturing, and the distribution of a potential COVID-19 vaccine. So that is where we're trying to figure out where the money is coming from and how to speed things up. Also, traditionally, the vaccine developing process has been done step by step. You first do the animal studies. Following animal studies, you do a phase one trial with few volunteers, followed by a phase two clinical trial, which may have 100 volunteers, to a much larger clinical trial that could have thousands of volunteers. That would be the phase three. And instead of waiting to do a phase one, phase two, and phase three trial, what many companies are doing now is sort of developing together. Do a phase one trial with the animal studies. Do a phase one and two trial. And instead, for example, of waiting for a candidate that meets all the good checkboxes to have the vaccine appropriately before we start making it, companies are putting are betting that their candidates are going to be good, and they're being encouraged by the government to take the risk of starting to manufacture those vaccines before they are approved. So if a good candidate comes out, the vaccines are already being manufactured, and we don't have to wait to see if it works or not. That, of course, can cause a loss to a company, because if the vaccine is a dud, they're going to lose that money. But since there are multiple candidates being tested simultaneously in many different countries, including the U.S., they are banking in one of them is going to actually be able to stick and produce the kind of immunity desired to protect people against the virus that caused COVID-19.
So, Marcos, we've been talking a lot about development. Of course, then there's production. And
yes,
are there estimates of how many doses we might need right from the start to be able to address this pandemic globally?
That's an excellent question. And most of the studies that I have seen are thinking about the U.S., having hundreds of thousands of doses. But COVID needs to be treated at a global scale. So only having vaccines to the U.S. may not put an end to the pandemic, because globalization has made it that people travel over the world. So it is necessary then to have a vaccine that is going to be affordable and produced at very large scale to reach not only people in the U.S., but everybody. And that's why many organizations like the Doctors Without Borders are encouraging organizations to try to make the vaccine available at cost. So somebody, so foundation can help the companies guard themselves against some of that losses, because otherwise a vaccine may not be available for everybody, and it's not going to be useful if it's only available for people who can afford it. So I don't know if I can give you an exact number to answer mm-hmm. your question more directly, but I'm imagining that we're going to be requiring millions of doses to be able to be distributed around the entire world.
Well, and Dr. Anthony Fauci of that White House Coronavirus Task Force said just last mm-hmm. week that in his estimation, a vaccine for the novel coronavirus may not provide long-lasting protection.
Yes.
So does that mean it might be more like a flu shot than, say, one against measles, where we get it maybe one in a booster and then we're good for pretty much our lives?
That is an interesting point, because I guess as part of the speed that we're trying to develop vaccines, we're thinking about the safety. We want to ensure that this is the safest vaccine possible, but it may not be the vaccine that gives us the heaviest amount of protection. And I think that that is a gamble that people are willing to take, to get a vaccine that protects a good number of people, but it's not maybe the most perfect vaccine, as long as the vaccine has a high level of safety. And then use that as a first wave of prevention until new vaccines are developed that could be a lot more effective at preventing the illness. So that may get us into a cycle like the one that you describe, where eventually we're going to be having vaccines coming around that are going to be better, more effective, and therefore increase the amount of protection of the global population.
So it sounds like what you're saying, Marcos, is that there is room in the market for more than one vaccine, and possibly more than one type of vaccine, if we're
Absolutely.
Going to have any hope of stemming the coronavirus pandemic.
Absolutely. That is correct. Taking a single approach, like putting all our eggs in one basket, it's not going to work to try to fight this pandemic with only one vaccine. And this is why molecular approaches, this is why the tested and tried approaches are all being looked into, taken into consideration to try to reach a vaccine that eventually is going to be effective and be able to help a lot of people.
Well, Marcos, thank you so much for joining us today and helping us to understand the complexities of this situation.
My pleasure, Judith, and thank you for having me over in the show.
Marcos Garcia Ojeda is a professor of molecular and cell biology at the University of California, Merced. He joined us to discuss his piece for the conversation titled, What Needs to Go Right to Get a Coronavirus Vaccine in 12 to 18 Months. You can find a link to that article over at WPR.org/Central Time and just look for the program note for this segment. That's Marcos Garcia Ojeda. With a lot of activities going virtual, WPR is getting in on the fun with our virtual Beethoven's Fifth Symphony 5K run, walk, and roll. I think many of us would agree, music lifts our spirits, and we are told often how much exercise is important to keep us healthy. We're making it easy to celebrate both with WPR's virtual Beethoven's Fifth Run, Walk, Roll this month. So not only does this virtual race let you go at your own pace, you can even do it on your own schedule. No crowds, no parking, no official starting line, no need for setting your alarm for an early morning start if you don't feel like it. Here's how it works. You run, walk, or roll 3.1 miles, that's 5K, or more, while listening to Beethoven's Fifth. You map your own outdoor route or use a treadmill, track your own time, and report it back to us. And we just ask that you complete your race between June 13th and 20th. Every registered runner gets a free customized print-at-home race bib you can wear for running and photos. Head over to WPR.org/events for more information. Great news, it is free, but you can buy your own Beethoven's Fifth 5K shirt to support WPR. Running, rolling, and walking with Beethoven and you, this is Central Time.